Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you are a person of a certain age, chances are that hanging out at the local music store was a rite of passage for you as a teenager and young adult. For some of us, the bins were full of CDs. For others, it was LPs and tapes, even 8-tracks. But if we wanted to listen to the music we liked whenever we wanted it, we had to pay for a physical recording. Today, while we love music as much as ever, it is very clear that fewer and fewer fans feel the need to purchase it for themselves. A distribution chain once controlled by record companies broke with the advent of digital file sharing and fell into the hands of tech-savvy pirates whose goals of leaking music for free online has forever changed the music industry as we knew it. Journalist Stephen Witt explains how it happened in his new book, How Music Got Free: The End of an Industry, the Turn of the Century, and the Patient Zero of Piracy. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Your path to this story is an interesting one. At a certain point in your young adult life, I guess as a college student, you had thousands of downloaded albums in your collection that you had not paid for. How did you start wondering who was behind all those shared files?
Well, as you say, I had thousands, in fact, tens of thousands of pirated leaked albums on my hard drives, which I had been accumulating since 1997. And if you queued up my music library, it'd take you about a year and a half to listen to it all. At some point, I was like, why, you know, where did this come from? Why have I done this? And I began to investigate, really how those MP3s got onto my hard drive. And I found the most fascinating thing, which was that almost all of the music that I had could be traced back to just one of three people.
Yeah, what's really astonishing, I think, for me in reading this book is that I had kind of seen this as a crowdsourcing phenomenon, that little by little, lots of different people were contributing to all this. And in fact, it was pretty concentrated.
Well, I thought so, too, at first. Like, you know, how did it get there? Well, there's just probably random people in their dorm rooms, in their bedrooms, ripping their CDs to the internet and posting them. But that's not the case. Actually, there's a secret underground of pirates who make it their goal to infiltrate the music industry's supply chain, getting inside compact disc manufacturing plants and radio stations to leak pre-release albums out. And they end up being the primary supplier of almost all music on the internet, or at least that used to be true.
How much of their motivation was financial?
None. Which is pretty amazing. With few exceptions, for the most part, the ethos of this underground community, who is called The Scene, which is short for the software scene or the wares scene, wasn't driven by profit. For the most part, it was really driven by a sort of sense of going after the corporate labels and hurting them in some ways. I think a lot of these guys started out as teenage boys, and they were seeking thrills. And they found them by getting inside and leaking albums.
I was, let's go back in history a little bit here. I was surprised to learn that the format we now automatically associate with digital music, the MP3, has its origins back in the 1980s.
That's right. It actually has its origins in about 1982, which is the year the compact disc debuted. At that time, a German audio engineer named Dieter Seitzer decided, well, this compact disc, it looks great, but it's not really an efficient method of distribution. What we should do is store all these digital music files on a computer server somewhere, and then have the average person call in on their telephone and request them. Then they can hook their telephone up to their stereo and we'll stream it to them. So this is 1982, right? Like, and he's proposing something
that would have been big stuff in 82. Yeah.
Yeah, Spotify. So he filed for a patent on this, and that patent was rejected because they had no workable method to shrink the files enough to fit them through the narrow data pipe of the telephone line. He deputized one of his graduate students, a brilliant engineer named Karl-Heinz Brandenburg, to solve this problem. And Brandenburg realized that the ear, because of certain inherited anatomical imperfections, couldn't actually hear most of the frequencies on the compact disc, and therefore they could be deleted or compressed. And with this insight, by the early 90s, he had created an encoder that today we would call the MP3.
What made the MP3 such an ideal format for sharing files online?
It was just so small. It took a compact disc and shrunk it to about 10% of its original size, with only minimal losses in audio quality. And that just made it perfect, because if you can go back in time a little bit and remember, when bandwidth was kind of a scarce resource. If you're on your modem at 52,000 kilobytes per, or bits per second, trying to get files through the internet, they've got to be pretty tiny if you're going to do it in any kind of scale.
So Brandenburg kept advocating for the MP3, even as other like more cumbersome offerings were winning the day. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So for a while, he was completely locked out of the marketplace. The recording industry just had no interest in this technology. So even once the tech was there to do these streaming services, the record companies were just like, no way, because they were making such fat profits off the compact disc. Eventually, in desperation, in 1995, he posted this encoder for free download online, kind of a limited use encoder that could maybe crack or maybe could maybe copy 20 files at a time before it self-destructed. But the software crackers got a hold of it, and they broke it open to enable full functionality. And very soon, there were tens, hundreds, and hundreds of thousands of pirated files swarming that sort of early internet.
So was it pirates that determined that the MP3 would be the format for music?
Yes. Pirates. Pirates and consumers. There were several different competing devices that could do the same thing. One was called the MP2, which actually sounds like it was successor to the MP3, antecedent to the MP3, but it was not. They were developed in parallel and were rival technologies. The pirates gravitated towards the MP3 because it produced the best sound quality with the lowest amount of information. Very soon, they started out, actually, if you can believe this, by burning compact discs to floppy disks and then mailing those four or five at a time through the U.S. Postal Service. But by 96 or 97, they'd sort of moved to online campus servers. And I matriculated in 97, and so that's sort of why I first started seeing it.
One would think that the music industry would have seen the writing on the wall.
One would think so.
But why did that not happen?
You have to remember that these guys were not themselves technologists. This was a different era. The idea that everything was going to be digitized and distributed online was not yet clear, I think, to a lot of people. And if you look at how badly sort of the newspaper industry and several other industries reacted as well, you'll see that. It wasn't clear to anyone, really. These guys who ran the music labels, their primary job was to sort of massage, you know, the egos of famous best-selling artists and to get more hits out of them. Technical problems of distribution were very far down their list of concerns. So what happened was when the MP3 came along, they sort of told the inventors of it, well, we're not interested in digital music distribution. What they didn't realize is that they were already engaged in digital music distribution. Those racks of compact discs at the mall looked to them like inventory, but to an engineer, they were just an array of inefficiently stored data.
All right, let's talk about Del Glover, a guy who made history, in a sense, from a highly unlikely place.
Yeah. So Del is really the soul of this book, and he's one of my favorite people I've ever met. He was a worker on a packaging line at a compact disc factory who made the leap between inventory and digital management that his bosses could not. What he realized is that if he could get the discs out of the plant and post them to the internet, he'd be available to sort of be the primary source of all leaked music weeks and sometimes months ahead of their release dates. Over the course of 7 years, he leaked about 2,000 albums out of the plant where he worked in North Carolina, including most of the major hits of the era, with a special focus on rap. So he leaked Eminem, Kanye West, 50 Cent, Dr. Dre, and including other big-selling artists like Justin Bieber and Taylor Swift. It all went back to this one guy. Once he posted it on the internet, you know, that stuff would make it onto the peer-to-peer networks, onto stuff like Kazaa and LimeWire and the torrents, and from there to iPods around the globe, usually within about 24 hours. So if you ever had music on your hard drive and you weren't sure where it came from, it probably passed through Del's hands.
How did he realize? I mean, the company did, in its defense, have a policy that told workers they weren't supposed to be stealing things. How did he realize that theft was actually rampant before he even started doing it?
There was sort of even before this had happened, he would go to parties in the 90s held by plant workers. And he would hear all this music that he'd never heard before. And he was a big music fan. He was a clubber. He sort of was into music. And eventually he realized, wait, this music is coming out of the plant. Like, these technicians are smuggling it out. Now, Universal knew that, you know, their inventory was very valuable and they didn't want it to leak. So they devised a security system sort of similar to a customs way station, where as you'd leave, you'd swipe your identification badge and a light would go off. 4 times out of 5, it was green, let's say. One time out of five, it was red. If you got the red light, they took you over to a booth and, you know, swiped your body with an aluminum detecting wand that would look for that thin aluminum core of the compact disc. So Dell and his confederates had to figure out a way to get it past that. Eventually, what they realized is that everybody in the plant was wearing these large belt buckles. And when the guys wanded your belt buckle, they never made you take it off. So they realized that by stuffing the discs inside a rubber glove behind their belt buckle and then sort of crossing their fingers as they went through the way station, they could usually get the music out.
It sounds very uncomfortable, but I guess... It led the way, again, to this sort of, maybe superstardom is the wrong idea, but this sense that he was part of something that felt exciting.
I think so. He was the Edward Snowden of music, or maybe the Aaron Swartz. And the group that he joined actually had dozens of people like this around the globe. They were called Rabid Neurosis, and the Justice Department would later call them the most prolific and notorious internet piracy group of all time, which they were. So they had guys in Japan who would go to sort of offset international release dates and get stuff on the net early that way. They, like as I said before, they had music journalists in the United Kingdom who were getting, you know, pre-release albums for review who would leak stuff. They had radio DJs in this conspiracy. They had guys who did in Italy who were doing like music promotional businesses who would also get pre-release leaks. And they had guys inside BET and MTV as well getting stuff out very early. So to join this group, you sort of had to show up with leaked material on your own. Once you got in, though, you had sort of free access to the vast majority of the humanity's cultural output from the last 50 years.
Yeah, so what kind of deal did Glover work out with Rabid Neurosis, which is sometimes abbreviated RNS, for going to not just the trouble of uploading all this stuff, but frankly, the risk of it?
Well, he was breaking the rules, not just of his employer's rules, but also this group's rules. You know, the group had a longstanding idea that the leaks were not to be sold. You weren't supposed to make money off of this. But Dell was interested in money. So he downloaded a lot of movies and crack games from these servers where other people in other supply chains were also burrowing their way in. So let's say there's some Oscar DVD screeners. Somehow one of these pirates gets a hold of it and posts it to the net. Dell takes it home. He's got a tower of DVD duplicators, and he makes hundreds of copies of this thing. Then he goes to his car, and he sells it out of the trunk. This made him the best bootlegger in the state of North Carolina. And his operation got so elaborate that he actually had to branch out. He started deputizing barbers in barbershops around the town where he lived in North Carolina, showing up with 400 or 500 discs on a spindle on consignment, and then coming at the end of the week to collect, you know, as much as $1,000 in cash. His best barbers actually made more money selling bootleg movies than they did cutting hair. So then, you know, this made him a lot of money.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Stephen Witt. His new book is called How Music Got Free: The End of an Industry, the Turn of the Century, and the Patient Zero of Piracy. If you've got a story to tell or a question to ask, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Stephen Witt. His new book is called How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Stephen, maybe this dates me, maybe it makes me uncool, but honestly, there are too many artists in my personal life to feel right about stealing music that someone else paid to produce. This had a real effect on jobs within the recording industry and not only at the executive level.
Yeah, it really hurt a lot of people. In particular, it hurt, you know, sound engineers, it hurt musicians, it hurt sort of the broader recording industry in general. I think they shed each year at Universal Music Group, which I focus on in the book, something like 1,000 to 2,000 jobs each year for 3 or 4 consecutive years. So there was a lot of pain, and a lot of people were forced out of the industry entirely. Now, you could say, well, how many people do you need to have running the industry in the digital era? Certainly fewer than the compact disc era. So maybe some of that shrinkage is sort of what, you know, we euphemistically term creative destruction. But a lot of it came from copyright infringement.
So tell us about Doug Morris. He was running Universal during the years that piracy was really gutting the entire industry. How did he become aware of the extent of the damage, and what was his initial response?
Morris was arguably the most powerful music executive of all time. He was in charge of Universal Music Group in 99 and 2000. That was the year that the recording industry experienced its peak profitability, and he was running the largest firm. After the Grammys, the day after the Grammys, I think in 2000, Hillary Rosen, the head of the Recording Industry Association of America, sort of forced all of the music executives into a room and demonstrated what Napster was to them and how it worked and the existential crisis that it posed, or the existential threat, anyway, that it posed to their business. Morris reacted, I would say, badly, as did almost every recording industry executive. He tried a couple things. He tried starting his own online music store called Press Play, which, if anybody has ever used this thing, was just a total disaster. It lasted about 18 months. He tried suing the end users of peer-to-peer services under a program that was known inside the record industry as Project Hubcap, whereby they would subpoena the IP addresses of users of services like Kazaa and LimeWire, and then just file basically random lawsuits against average downloaders. And that was just a nightmare for them. It made them very little money, and it caused them all sorts of ill will. And then finally, they teamed up with Steve Jobs and said, "Okay, well, we're gonna license our music for your Apple iTunes Music Store." But arguably, this hurt them too, because it disaggregated the single from the album. You know, back in '99, you know, if you wanted to buy, let's say, an NSYNC song, you had to get the whole album to get it. But in '04 and '05, you could just buy the single. And since nobody needs 12 NSYNC songs, that, you know, they ended up just buying. I mean, one is more than enough, right? So.
Well, you know, it's funny about the iTunes store because it worked until it didn't. Over the weekend, of course, we heard that Taylor Swift published this op-ed on her Tumblr page asking Apple, taking Apple to task for essentially not planning to pay artists any royalties for the first 3 months of their proposed new streaming service. I'm curious, first of all, how a streaming site could legally claim the right to pay no royalties.
Well, if the artist signs the contract that says that they will do that, then it's legal, right? Apple was essentially trying to strong arm the musicians into a sort of a loss leader deal for them. And there was a revolt. And I think Swift is in the right here. I think what she's managed to do is actually pretty extraordinary. But it bodes poorly for the streaming services, because if they start to get more powerful musicians of her type to do this, they're going to earn even less money than they currently do, which is nothing. So at the same time, though, you know, remember Dieter Seitzer, the sort of forefather of the MP3, his original vision was for streaming. And when the music industry finally, you know, catches up to that, it's what stops piracy. Spotify has been very successful in getting the younger generation to move away from things like torrents and file sharing applications to paying actually quite a lot each month for their music. But I think the majority of Spotify's subscribers right now are under the age of 27.
But they're not paying anywhere near what they would pay if they were buying albums or even individual tracks.
Oh, no, that's false. They're paying way more.
Really?
The average iTunes subscriber pays about $12 a year for music. The person who subscribes to Spotify pays $120. That's quite a lot. It's much more than most people. People don't buy 10 albums a year on average. It's quite a lot to spend. The problem is that Spotify has two tiers. One of its tiers is ad-supported and free, essentially, for the end user. And that's essentially, those people are freeloading off the paid subscription tier. But, you know, Apple thinks it can get to 100 million streaming users. If it does that at $10 a month, that means $12 billion in revenue. 70% of that is paid out to the artists, $9 billion. They should be able to make money off that.
So, Stephen, in the 2000s, the record industry realized there was something very bad happening. Not surprisingly, in addition to filing lawsuits, they thought, well, let's, you know, contact the FBI. Let's try to have the authorities help out with this problem. How did that all play out?
Well, they didn't have a very good reputation on Capitol Hill to begin with. For years earlier, people like Tipper Gore and Bill Bennett had tried to get them to institute a rating system for music similar to what we have in the with movies in the United States that the MPAA agreed to. But the recording industry would never do this, and they refused completely, kicking and screaming, ever to put any kind of rating system on music. And I think that's to their credit. I think it was good that they did that. I like that from a cultural perspective. But it really hurt them when it became time to have Congress help them go enforce their copyrights. And it wasn't really until the movie industry was threatened a little later on in 02 and 03 that the FBI started really aggressively going after the music pirates. Once that started to happen, these groups were very difficult to crack because they sort of lived in encrypted chat channels and they were totally anonymous. No one in the group would actually know who anyone else was. They had very few details about each other. So even if you managed to flip one of the pirates, there wasn't that much they could give you. It took them until 2007 to catch Del Glover, the leading music leaker of all time.
Glover had for a while thought, I'm done with this. What got him back into the leaking, if you want to call it business or hobby?
I talked to a lot of leakers, actually, and most of them talked about the sort of addictive dopamine rush that came from doing this. And this theme of trying to quit, essentially knowing that you're sort of either going to get caught for the FBI or you've kind of outgrown this activity, kept coming up. But it was very difficult for any of them to quit. People would quit two or three times and then they'd sort of, you know, feel this empty void in their life and then start, you know, endeavoring to leak albums again. So I think there's some kind of addictive property to it, whether that's just the addictive rush of doing something exciting or, you know, and sort of against the general malaise of your life or something deeper than that. I'm not sure.
What made it so hard for the FBI to get a foothold within loose organizations like Rabid Neurosis?
It's very hard to crack criminals on the internet. So a classic organized crime syndicate tends to be based on people who know each other very well. This is a real world one, like the mafia. Either they're all related, or they all grew up in the same neighborhood, or they all did time together. So they tend to have these very, very close ties to one another. The online crime syndicates are almost exactly the opposite of that. Almost nobody in the group knows who anybody else is. It's entirely anonymous, and it's entirely encrypted. And this makes it very hard because even, you know, in the classic model, you start from the bottom and then you flip your way up the chain, like The Wire or something. Or this is how they got the mafia as well. But it's very hard to do that with online conspiracies because even once you're inside the group, it's hard to get information about who else the other people on the other behind the chat channels, behind the screen handles actually are.
Could something have been done to, I guess, the source of this material that was getting leaked was CDs? Could something have been done to CDs to make it impossible to copy and duplicate them?
They've done various things. One thing they do is something called audio watermarking. What this is sort of invisible high frequency, inaudible high frequency tones in the CD that will allow you to trace back its general place of manufacture and origin, but which the end user can't hear. And in at least one case, they actually were able to do this with a Craig David, I think, CD, where someone leaked it, and because of this audio watermark, they were able to go back and say, we know where it came from. It came from this one particular batch of compact discs that we sent to BET. So they contacted BET and were like, listen, we know you leaked something. And BET said, yeah, and what are you going to do about it? So it's harder than you think, I think.
We have an email here from John who says, so far it seems your guest is lionizing theft. Does he have any critique of this behavior?
I certainly do. I don't think it's good to leak albums. You know, I wouldn't like it if someone did that to something that I was doing as a creative process.
Like your book.
Like my book. Fortunately, my book did actually leak several times. but the sort of final finished version of my book didn't get posted on the internet until, I think, 14 or 15 hours before it was supposed to come out. So that, I don't think that hurt me too badly. And I did pirate my own copy just to be sure it was the right book, which is an experience I recommend. This is bad behavior. I don't mean to lionize it. You know, at the same time, I find it fascinating that people are willing to do this. And there is sort of a folk hero aspect to it.
We have an email here from Danny, who writes, back in the day, I did download several files from LimeWire. My justification was the files I was downloading were either DJ-only remixes, white label remixes, or others that weren't available to the general public, and that the shelf life of these remixes were pretty limited. There were all kinds of things available online that weren't actually being sold in record stores.
That's absolutely true, including many albums that were available only on vinyl and had never been digitized, some of which were incredible. So I think that did drive a lot of people. But, you know, people like free stuff, and that drove a lot of people, too. The question when it comes to file sharing, which is sort of a different thing than leaking albums, you know, the music industry always wanted to equate it with theft. But it's a little bit different. You know, if I take your compact disc and you don't have it anymore, then I've harmed you. But if I just make a copy of your compact disc and you get to keep it, who have we harmed? It's actually a third-party rights holder who's supposed to get paid whenever we do this. But if that person isn't around to enforce their copyright, is it even a crime?
Tell us about Oink.
Oink was a torrent site, private invitation-only torrent site, that for a time became the largest music library on the planet. And this was essentially a communal enterprise with people uploading their own CD collections and others that they could find, comprising ultimately close to a million albums. Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails once referred to it as the greatest music store in the world, which I think it was, primarily because it was also all free. But it was a community, and it was kind of operated under principles similar to what we think of as Wikipedia. It was sort of, you know, crowdsourced work that was done without any expectation of in-kind reward. Eventually, they had so much music on it that they didn't have anything left to upload, so they moved into audiobooks. And at that time, Harry Potter, I think 104 disc collection of Stephen Fry reading the entire Harry Potter series appeared online. J.K. Rowling's lawyers are very aggressive, and they found out about this. And eventually they brought the site down, arresting its founder and charging him with racketeering.
There are, I suppose, lots of different ways that you can manage one of these sites and lots of different kinds of rules that you can set. You can either say, just throw up here whatever you can find, or you can be really exacting about it.
Yeah. And the guy who founded Oink was a guy named Alan Ellis. He was a university student in the UK, and he was just a total audiophile snob. So he would only allow you to post sort of a lossless copy of the compact disc master. And once you got that, you would sort of have a bit-perfect reproduction of the original source. And people proved to be very interested in that, especially this kind of underground community of tech nerds who loved music. And so this drew a lot of people to Alan Ellis's site. After he was arrested, he tried to make the case that, you know, what he was doing was essentially almost like a commune, like kind of a digital sharing site, and that he was not a racketeer. And he was found not guilty.
And people were willing to jump through hoops in order to satisfy Ellis's requirements because that made them cool?
I don't think they were. I mean, how cool can you be behind an anonymous online avatar? You know, we have this phenomenon, and we see it in Wikipedia too, where people sort of just contribute to the creation of communal goods without any expectation, as I said before, of in-kind reward. So there must be something inside people that makes them want to do this.
Why was the music industry hit harder than other media industries that are producing things that can be digitized, like movies and like books?
The files were smaller to begin with, so it was easy to get them on there. Additionally, they were very slow to the game in sort of making, you know, meaningful alternatives to this method. Until Spotify appeared in maybe 07 or 08, really every offering they gave was inferior both technically and in terms of convenience to pirating. And so people, you know, even if they maybe had a problem with copyright infringement, still did it because it was the easiest way. You know, the way that they eventually got people to stop pirating was to just offer a better service. And that's what Spotify and similar services are.
What kinds of strategies have artists used to try to take back some control over how much they might be paid for what they're producing that clearly a lot of people want?
Right. So clearly a lot of people want it. And I think probably the biggest thing that you can do is sort of, well, people have tried a variety of things. So Lady Gaga tried selling her album for 99 cents and she sold a million copies of it, but it didn't make very much money. Tom York of Radiohead just distributes all his stuff as leaked torrents, essentially. You know, Beyonce tried her surprise video album, and that worked pretty well. It got people to pay. And then Taylor right now is sort of aggressively, you know, withholding her stuff from the streaming services, and she's bargaining very, very different. You know, she's driving a very tough bargain with the streaming services. So they sort of tried a variety of things. The thing that should be noted is that during this period of extreme leaking, the live music market has more than tripled in size, and that's created, that's driven primarily by the availability of free music.
We'll talk about that in just a minute with my guest, journalist Stephen Witt. His new book is How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. You can join us by finding me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email think@kera.org or call in. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Stephen Witt. His new book is called How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Before the break, Stephen, you were talking about sort of the rise of these, larger than ever live stage shows for some performers. It was really strange a few weeks ago. I saw like Bono and the guys from U2 big time shilling their live concert with Jimmy Fallon, like talking about, you know, the quality of the speakers, things that artists in the past would not have sort of lowered themselves to talk about. And it became clear that a big source of their revenue now is not selling albums or even cuts. It is getting people to show up in person to see them perform.
Yeah, this is where the money is. Economists theorize that sort of music consumers have a fixed budget that they're willing to spend each year on entertainment. And as spending on recording goes down, on recorded music goes down, it starts to go up on live music. And empirically, that does seem to be the case. The recording industry was basically cut in half since 2000, but the live music market has tripled, driven especially by these large-scale sort of bundled concerts, stuff like Bonnaroo and Coachella, which people just love.
So that's totally great for artists that have enough of a following that they are a draw. But I'm wondering what this portends for people who are trying to get established, who don't, even if they become an overnight, you know, YouTube sensation, don't have, the mechanism behind them to do a national tour.
Well, usually the labels are willing to hoover these people into these contracts very quickly. There's a guy named The Weeknd who's sort of rocketed to superstardom recently. He started off in his bedroom making music and beats about in 2011, so 4 years ago. And he headlined Barclay Center last year. And this year he sort of was the closing act at the Apple Music ceremony launch. So he's getting paid, even though he started out giving away his music for free. And that's a new and emerging model. Now, for maybe smaller bands, that's going to be a little harder to do, but it was never that easy for them anyway. I'm not sure what the answers are, but I don't think we can go back to the old model very easily.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Mark on the line in Dallas. Hello, Mark.
How you doing?
Great, thank you.
Good.
I'm a long-time listener. I really enjoy your show.
Thanks.
Listen, I wanted to make some comments about what you're talking about here. You know, there was a... There's an artist, Lil Wayne, who did something I thought was fairly remarkable a couple of years ago. And he posted all his songs, the new songs that he was recording, onto a website. And then he gave them literally over the Internet where people could, just listen to them. And then he put counters on those songs. And he paid attention to what people were listening to. He watched those numbers very carefully for a couple of years before he released a new album. Then when he released the new album, he just simply released the top songs, the songs that people were listening to, and he released an album that appeared on the chart at number one.
What do you want to say about that, Stephen?
Mark is exactly right. No artist has done a better job with the Internet than Lil Wayne. The thing to remember about Wayne is that he was actually had been signed to a recording contract label or a recording label contract since he was about 12 years old. And he sort of had these minor hits in the mid 90s. And this is hard to remember now. But by 2003 or 2004, he was considered completely washed up. I mean, he was kind of an industry joke, you know, one of these kid rappers who never sort of makes it to the big time. In 05 and 06, he completely rebooted his career by embracing the internet model in a way that had never been done before. He moved to sort of almost like a BuzzFeed model of production, where he was constantly releasing new music for free on the internet without much promotion or hype. I think in 2005, or maybe it was 06, he appeared on over 200 tracks, either as a featured artist or it was his own recording. This really got the attention of sort of the blogosphere at the time. You know, taste-making websites like Vice and Pitchfork Media really started gravitating to him in a way that it would have been unimaginable even a few years earlier for like a Manny Fresh album. 08, and I believe the album that Mark is talking about is the Carter III. You know, he had the number one album in the country. By doing exactly what Mark said, paying very close attention to what people wanted to hear by sort of, you know, releasing tons of music on the internet and then letting it come back to him. Now, it should be said, though, the album Mark is talking about that was number one sold fewer than 3 million copies in 2008. And in the year 2000, that wouldn't even have put it in the top 10.
Is the subscription model sustainable, and will it have to be adjusted in some way to make it on into the future?
Right now, it's great for customers because the companies that run these subscription models are losing money and the artists aren't getting paid. So the beneficiary is the listener. As you point out, that's not a sustainable phenomenon. I suspect what will start to happen is a fragmentation of the media landscape, where artists will sign big exclusive deals with certain streaming contracts, and simultaneously we'll begin to see price hikes or limits of use. I'm not really sure what the end stage of this looks like, but Spotify can't lose $200 million a year in perpetuity. So whatever they're offering now will have to change in the future. And that's true for the other big streamers as well. You know, the biggest streaming site is actually YouTube. It's kind of the world's jukebox now. We sort of think of it as this democratic experiment in amateur video, but that's kind of the old model. Right now, 29 of the 30 most viewed videos on YouTube are professionally produced music videos. And I suspect that will continue in the future. YouTube itself, with 1 billion viewers, is just breaking even. So they haven't really solved it either.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Susan now in Richardson. Hi, Susan.
Hello. I am sort of pigtailing on to Chris's comment earlier about it costing jobs and things. And my question is really, is it the detachment that such social media and the anonymous aspect of it allows young people today, that they feel like it's that they don't want to pay for anything, basically, and they feel no compunction, including my own children and their very professional jobs and family, about doing something that in reality they know affects other people's lives and income, but justify by saying, well, that's the direction in which things are going. The world is changing. And it's so appalling to me because I know that a lot of us work hard to instill social conscience in these same people, and they brush it aside today. Otherwise, they're good people.
What do you think, Stephen?
I compare it to the generational shift that affected the previous generation with regards to experimentation with illegal drugs. Almost everybody in my generation stole music. I mean, not everyone, but almost everyone. So there was a widespread generational shift about what behavior could be considered acceptable online. And so is that evidence of corroded morals that are going to collapse our society? Or is it evidence of just a different way of looking at things? And I guess the answer to that lies in the eyes of the beholder.
It is interesting, though. So you said you were in college in 97. I went to college and graduated in 92. I knew the roommate of a friend who worked at like Sound Warehouse and was notorious for stealing things from his employer. And we were all just a little bit appalled by that, like maybe envious on the one hand. And yet we wouldn't consider stealing a CD from a music store. And yet now there are a lot of people who just don't look at this as stealing, and yet the end result is the same, that you are getting content that you would otherwise have to pay for.
Well, look, you might not run drugs either, but you still might do them. Right?
I don't do either, just for the record. But
or let's put it this way. You might not bootleg DVDs yourself, but you might buy a knockoff bootleg off the street. Or for that matter, you might buy a knockoff Louis Vuitton handbag, which tons of people do. I mean, you see these guys selling sunglasses. They say Ray-Ban on it. It's $10. Are you a criminal for purchasing that?
Well, here's the question. Is there a disincentive, do you think, to artists to continue producing, particularly, you know, content that comes with a big cost, you know, to make something as amazing as it is? You talked about these music videos that are on YouTube. Is there a disincentive to the creation of art if people feel like they can't make a living to make it? Or should we just rely on the fact that artists want to put their stuff out into the world and we'll be fine?
Art is much older than commerce and speaks to basic human needs that are not going to go away. And people make music under any conceivable economic circumstances. History certainly shows that much. The question is to what extent, you know, having a budget improves the music. And I think it does. I think if you look at our mode of production, you know, guys like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, we sort of think of them as hippies. But you look closely, they were capitalists. They really enjoyed making money off their music. And I think the budgets they got fueled, you know, some really excellent stuff that they couldn't have done without access to those kind of resources. You know, having said that, the peak period of profitability for the music industry was, you know, late 90s, 99 and 2000. And what did they give us? You know, the Backstreet Boys and Spice Girls. So, I mean, was that, you know, really, was, I mean, was that, is that what money buys you? Because I'm not sure everybody wants that. You know, the period we're in now, where there's way less money in music, I actually think is a more creatively fertile period than that time was.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jonathan is on the line now in Fort Worth. Hey, Jonathan.
Hello. I just had a quick question, comment about the if there was a link between the downloading music, the pirating music, and then people taking that to go buy albums that they might not have bought in the first place without having legally gotten a song or two off of it.
Oh, so like they're sampling first and then they decide, I'm going to go ahead and buy this thing.
Yeah.
This behavior definitely did occur for a while, particularly in the late 90s and early 2000s. But the difference then was that an MP3 was still kind of an inferior good to a compact disc. You couldn't listen to it in your car. You couldn't take it running. It was hard to DJ a party with like your gigantic computer lugging it everywhere. As technology became more mobile, though, the MP3 began to rival the compact disc in value and eventually exceeded it because it was so easy to port and move. So I think that was true for a while, but I think as we entered the 2000s, it became very not true at all. But I will say that the widespread availability of music absolutely spurs people's interest in music and spurs their desire to go out and find new bands and maybe pay for concert tickets to go see them. I don't think something like Bonnaroo would be nearly as successful if people couldn't hear all the bands on the lineup first.
Stephen, record companies such as they are will always need artists. Will artists always need record companies?
I get asked this question a lot, and it's a really good question. I don't have a great answer. I'm an author. I need a publisher. You know, I don't think if I'd self-publish this book, I'd be on this program right now. So even artists who start off almost totally independently need the publicity and marketing push that only a big label can provide. Having said that, you know, the label currently takes about 90% of the economics from their sales, and that's way too much in the digital era. I think it'd be better if you had something closer to a 50-50 split. And I noticed for some of the streaming services that the labels are moving in that direction.
Who else besides the artists we've talked about, Lil Wayne and Taylor Swift, who else is doing creative things that you think might be a great model moving forward for artists who want to realize at least a reasonable portion of the profits from their work?
Well, I think you have two modes. One is Taylor, who is just locking everything up and just, you know, essentially playing hardball, demanding that she get paid for her music. Now, she can kind of get away with that because her fan base is many of them are still trapped in the compact disc era. You know, she started out in country, and that's where still most CDs are sold. You know, she can sell a million CDs at Walmart. I don't think someone like Drake can do that. Maybe Drake can, but I don't think someone who's starting out like The Weeknd can do that. So there's a separate model that's pursued by the rappers, which is essentially just to put everything online in large volume and maybe somewhat lower production quality, with the hope that something just sticks. And once you catch that wave, try to monetize it. There's an artist named Fetty Wap right now who has the most streamed single on Spotify in the U.S. for the past 6 months. He's only really ever put out a couple songs. He doesn't have an album, and he's making a lot of money. So that's the other approach.
Why did you pick Spotify when the time came for you to get rid of your collection of purloined music?
Ideologically, I had a lot of problems with the way it works. You essentially become a corporate media serf, right? You give up all your rights, and you decide you're just going to license everything from this large, you know, protected library on an ongoing basis, and you have no power over what you get access to. Practically, though, it was just really convenient. And I think that's what actually drives people's behavior, if you look.
The new book by journalist Stephen Witt is called How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. Stephen, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Chris, this was great. Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.